Hello and welcome to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Now, this week, we are announcing a very, very brief change. We are sending the podcast off on its podcast holiday to the podcast beach to recharge its batteries for the month of August. However, Lucy, we thought we cannot possibly allow our listeners to go uncatered for in the ear department, can we?
No, that would be a terrible dereliction of duty. So we have put together some programmes to, we hope, delight and sustain you throughout the month of August. Some nuggets and jewels and ideas and highlights of what we've been talking about over the past year. And also, we're still going to be around here chatting about the stuff we chat about, which is, you know, gardens and books. And especially, we're not going to forget our secondhand book challenge, because Alex, we've been hearing from more of our lovely listeners, haven't we, this week?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're writing in your droves. Thank you so much. We have a wonderful letter from someone who says, some years ago, while doing research for a historical novel set in the 1930s, I came across what appeared to be a complete run of Left Book Club volumes tucked away at the back of Barter Books in Alnwick. And then he says, needless to say, when I left, the collection was no longer quite complete.
So that's a brilliant find, isn't it?
It is. I mean, can you imagine? I guess that must have been, you know, in its entirety, would have been huge. He wouldn't have bought the whole thing. But do you think, I mean, immediately some of them had gone, you know, gone out with him. I assume people just started to kind of put the collection back together. It's
yes,
those wonderful sort of never-ending fourth bridge sort of tasks.
Yes, constantly renewing itself. We had another letter actually from a wonderful listener. This one's not about the secondhand books, though we will carry on talking about secondhand books, and please don't stop looking out for them and telling us about them. Another letter at letters@the-tls.co.uk. I'll tell you the title of it. The title of it is The TLS and Cat. So we like that already.
We already, that rose to the top. I mean, don't think we ever, you know, we read in strict order, but occasionally something might rise to the top of the post bag.
So it says here, I thought I would share this photo of my cat with an absolutely brilliant name, my cat Vincent Price, snoozing on my newest issue of the TLS. And then our lovely listener goes on to say lots of nice things about the podcast, which I can't possibly say and it will spare our blushes, but we are very happy to hear your comments, especially when they're as nice as that. The problem here is that we didn't see the picture of Vincent Price. I don't know whether it didn't come through or the attachment didn't work, but please, would
send
you mind?
Send us Vincent Price.
Yes, we're longing to see. I think, in my mind, he's a very tall, elegant, skinny grey cat, but maybe I'm being too literal. What do you think, Alex?
Well, I think he might be a sort of bruiser. I mean, you're right, that would fit the actual Vincent Price, wouldn't it? But I'm wondering if he's a great big Tom who just makes his presence felt. Who can say? We need to know.
Perhaps he's a tiny winsome kitten or a she. Let's not be binary about this. We're agog about Vincent Price. But Alex, what's going up on this week's show anyway?
Well, we're kind of going a bit holiday vibe in the beginning of August. So we remembered that the wonderful Mary Beard came in to tell us about what the Romans brought back from their holidays. That was back in May, and we discovered some amazing things, didn't we? We discovered that people buying little T-shirts, you know, saying, I went to Paris and all I got was this lousy T-shirt, etc., were not an invention of the recent past at all.
The summer is nearly upon us and many people's thoughts will turn to holidays and travel. And if you do go on holiday somewhere, you might bring something back, a T-shirt, a figurine, a reminder of the beauties of your trip, or just a fun thing. Lots of people do, of course, and it turns out we've been doing this for centuries. Our own classics editor, Mary Beard, has reviewed two new books on the subject of ancient souvenirs, and she's here with us now, wearing her Kiss Me Quick hat, I imagine, and she's going to guide us through the Styx of Rock and the Venus de Milo statuettes. Mary, thank you for joining us. I'm sorry for revealing to the world that you're wearing your Kiss Me Quick hat.
I know, it looks great. I look great in it.
Definitely. So you start your piece by telling us about a trip that Hadrian took in 130 BCE. What was he going to see and how do we know about that trip?
This journey by Hadrian is one of my kind of favourite, you know, favourite moments in ancient history. of all time, really, because Hadrian was the greatest traveling emperor. Now, unlike others, some of whom just stayed in Rome, basically, Hadrian went sightseeing, not just, you know, he didn't just go to fight the barbarians, he went sightseeing. And his most famous sightseeing episode is when he goes to what the city we now call Luxor in Egypt to see the great colossal statues, which were already 1,000 years old by the time he got there, great pharaonic statues. Now, there are all kinds of things which are kind of odd about this trip, because Hadrian goes to see these statues just after he's lost his beloved boyfriend in the Nile, a mysterious case of drowning. And so you imagine that the atmosphere in the imperial party was not as joyous as it might have been. But what they were going to is one of the most famous tourist sites ever in the ancient world, to see these colossal statues. And it was not just because they were colossal that they were famous. It was that one of them was supposed to sing to you if you were lucky. We don't quite know how this worked, but we don't quite know whether it wasn't a trick by some good entrepreneurs in ancient Luxor. But if you went at dawn, it made a kind of whistling singing noise. And that was what you went to see. It was a miraculous statue. And we know that Hadrian went one morning and the damn statue didn't sing. So they had to go back the next day and it did sing. Now, why we know about this, though, is even in some ways more interesting. It's because one of the ladies in Hadrian's party, a woman called Julia Balbilla, composed some poetry about this occasion, about the failure of the statue to sing on day one, but the successful singing on day two. And she actually had someone carve it into the leg of the statue itself. So, you know, a bit of
vandalism.
A bit of vandalism. And heavens, he was not the only one, because one of the things that you did if you went to see this statue was you left your mark on it. And there's sort of 100 or so carvings, you know, a kind of Kilroy was here sort of moment on the leg and body of the statue, where people say, I came and I heard it, or it worked for me. And so you've got that kind of, I mean, I think it's a sort of exciting direct connection with the past, you know, because, you know, I've been to see these statues and there, I look at it and it's, you know, an old pharaonic statue, but there on its leg is this lady who visited it in 130.
And you can still clearly see that and read it.
And you can still see it and read it. You know, it is exciting. Mm.
Suppose one of the things that tells you, obviously, is that there weren't sort of tourist sites in that, because there wasn't tourism. So, I mean, your first thought is, well, you'd never be able to carve something on the leg of a statue now, because it would be, you know, behind ropes, and you know, you couldn't get anywhere near it, could
you'd
you?
You'd end up in the nick, I think.
Exactly. There was a more sort of, I suppose, being the emperor, you know, helps, obviously. But there was a more sort of direct physical sort of interaction between things that people visited.
And I think that's important, and that I think is what's very in your face when you look at this, because the emperor obviously has and the emperor's party, you know, get a bit more free reign than other people. But, you know, loads of people, there are other women, the governor of Egypt's wife, you know, this kind of thing. They've also left their mark. And, you know, I couldn't, you know, because of my job professionally, I couldn't possibly recommend that people tried to do this anywhere themselves, because they would, of course, get into trouble. But I think there is something sort of nice about that memorialization of your presence at a monument. I suppose now we do it with selfies, don't we? I mean, you know, the selfie, which everybody says, oh, gosh, you know, how tedious they, you know, people only come to this monument. And what do? They take a picture of themselves on their phones, you know. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of important. You know, when we go to these tourist sites, we want to kind of memorialize our visit there. And we do it in different ways. So I think the selfie is, you know, it's quite an important bit of modern touristic culture.
You heard it here first. No, I'm sure that is it. I'm sure that is true, that people, it's a very human thing to want to do, to say, look, I really was here. It really did happen and I can look back on it.
I was really there. And I think that's, you know, I think we should be a bit more tolerant of that. You know, you look, you go to the Louvre and you look at endless people having, you know, doing selfies in front of the Mona Lisa. And you, you know, you do think, oh, how irritating, I want to see this painting, whatever. But actually, you know, they're doing what Hadrian's party did. In 130, they're kind of they're marking their presence. They're remembering it. It's souvenir, you know, to remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Mary, I must say, about to go completely off track here, but we encourage digression, don't we, on this podcast, Lucy?
Yes, she said with trepidation.
It puts me in mind of many years ago. My husband was covering the World Cup in Germany, and his duties took him to Nuremberg, and he was sort of walking around looking at it before there was a match there and looking at this, you know, absurd monument to fascism. And he saw that somebody had written the word Cypress Hill on one of the seats. And Cypress Hill, an American black rap band. And he thought how much Hitler would have hated that. And so that this moment of sort of, I was here,
yes,
is sometimes it really kind of juxtaposes past and present in a way that's actually very satisfying, yeah, sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, quite pleasing.
Yeah, and quite constructive, actually. You know, and yes. I think that in some ways, you know, if we think about our own current statue wars, you know, maybe a bit more constructive graffiti, you know, might be one way of engaging and showing our disapproval, if you like. Of some of these people who stand in public places around us, you know, don't just have to take them down. In some ways, you can actually kind of, you can pull them down to size in cleverer ways.
Mm.
And critique, I think, is one of the ways we do that, and always have.
So the Julia Balbilla did her graffiti, or got someone else to, as you say.
Imagine that she kind of hitched up her skirt, climbed up, and you know, with her tools. I don't think that's very likely. I think she probably paid quite a hefty sum to have a local craftsman immortalize her verses on the statue. Yeah.
Hadrian also, he commemorated his trips, didn't he? You said he was a great sightseer in his villa at Tivoli, which was actually a kind of great big sort of encampment, wasn't it? A bit great big area. What? How did he commemorate them? Tell us about his villa.
Well, I think the villa is very interesting. People now kind of take Hadrian's villa at Tivoli, you know, a bit for granted. In fact, as you say, it's the size of a town. Hadrian built this extraordinary city for himself, you know, a few miles outside Rome. But what is very special about it, apart from all its little kind of bits of luxury and its underground car park and things like that, underground chariot park.
Chariot park, brilliant.
One of the things he did was he replicated bits of his empire in inverted commas, in his villa. So he recreated the famous temple where the statue of the Aphrodite of Cnidos stood. He recreated Egyptian monuments. He had the Caryatids from the Athenian Acropolis displayed in front of him in his villa, as if somehow what he was doing was creating a microcosm of empire through its cultural highlights at this extraordinary country theme park, really, I suppose, is what it was.
It's an amazing idea. It makes it sound like Las Vegas, yeah, got the Eiffel Tower and the pyramids and, yeah, and all of that.
Yeah.
And everyone says, how awful. But actually, it's a kind of amazing thing to do.
Yes, you know, it is. You know, I think there must probably have been some people in the second century CE who thought how naff this is when they saw what Hadrian had done. But in some ways it is, you know, it's another way of memorialising. It's a way of, you know, you ask yourself the question of how do I fit into this world? How do I see it? How do I imagine it when I'm not there? And you know, one of the ways to do that, if you've got the money that Hadrian had, is of course to rebuild it. And you know, there's a long tradition of that too. You know, within Christian architecture in the Middle Ages, you know, there are people rebuilding the Holy Sepulchre in their local church. It's about making visible things that you want to remember. And I think we should knock it a bit less than we usually do.
I mean, we see it even now, don't we? See it at something like the cast courts at the Victoria and Albert Museum, where you can go and see Trajan's column and all that. I mean, it's obviously a tradition that hasn't entirely sort of died out, even kind of museum sort of circles.
I think absolutely. And you know, the cast courts, they were, you know, for a while, terribly unfashionable in the mid 20th century. You know, people thought, plastic casts, you know. How dreary, you know, plaster cast of Trajan's column, really. I think one of the sort of side benefits of postmodernism in a way has been that we've started to think about replicas and reproductions and imitations in a way that's a bit more generous to them.
I've always found them really mesmerising, actually. Mm. And partly that's because you stand next to them all together and you think, I'm in a room of these huge plaster casts, why? And they have this kind of sort of power of being all together, I suppose.
And also you experience them in a whole range of very different ways from the way you experience the original. It wasn't until I went quite recently that I realised you could actually sit in the bottom of Trajan's column. No, you could go inside it. It was sort of hollow. And so it gives you a different way of engaging with objects that somehow you think were just the same. You know, they are replicas, but they're doing something different to you. And, you know, I think that's like my Ouzo bottle that I bought in Plucker several years ago, full of not very nice Ouzo, but in the shape of the Venus de Milo, you know, and I have Venus de Milo on my mantelpiece. That's both about admiration, it's about cutting her down to size. It's about a joke, you know, because it's an Ouzo bottle, and it's about ownership. And I think the culture of those kind of memories, whether we call them souvenirs or not, is I think very interesting about what it says about us and how we want to engage with the places that we go.
So, as you say, Hadrian was able to do it by basically recreating it because, as you say, it was his empire and he had all the money. But you said also that so-called ordinary people did travel around a fair bit. People got around the empire, didn't they? So what did they bring back if they didn't have... what was their equivalent of the Venus de Milo statuette with Ouzo in?
Yes, well, they couldn't quite do what Hadrian did. And I don't think that people, very many people, except the very rich in the ancient world, went on holiday. But they did travel. The Romans, are much more mobile than we think. And when they went places, they also wanted to remember. They probably were going for work or whatever, but they wanted to remember. And they bought, it looks like, the sorts of things that we buy. There is a wonderful glass bottle in the shape of a famous statue from Antioch, the so-called Good Fortune Tyche of Antioch, probably originally filled with perfume or maybe the ancient equivalent of Ouzo. And there's something terribly similar to my Ouzo bottle, you know, that I'm going to this city, I've seen its famous statue, and yet I'm bringing it back in a different form. I'm bringing it back, you know, filled with something in glass. And one of the things that I think people aren't very well aware of, partly because they don't often get put on, you know, spotlight display in museums, often kind of crappy little things, but there are endless miniature replicas of some of the most famous works of art in antiquity. I mean, the statue of Athena that was inside the Parthenon, you know, you can find plenty of her in, you know, in cheap terracotta and or on little cheap gems. And you know, they're into the same mechanisms of of recall and ownership and souvenir, and no doubt partly present and gift that we are.
And also, I guess, telling somebody that you've been there.
Mm.
You know, you're displaying something to say, yes, of course I've been there, haven't you?
Yes, that's right. And of course, it's because in the ancient world, we don't know the history of these objects when we find them. So we're never quite sure whether the person who owned this little terracotta Athena, whether they'd been to Athens, or whether actually it was a sort of, it was a symbol that substituted for a visit. I mean, there are plenty of people, you know, who have postcards or posters on their wall, I do, of works of art that we've never actually seen. So they fulfill quite complicated, ambivalent relationship between the experience of viewing or the desire to view or the parade of a particular, you know, cultural cachet, I guess. It's no doubt it was as complicated in the ancient world as it was now.
There are disciplines, aren't there? You mentioned there are disciplines that study this kind of thing, kind of now, as it were, souvenir theory and theories of place. So can these help in figuring out what the Romans did with the objects and what they meant to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think they can. And I think that anyone who tried to look at ancient souvenirs as what clearly some of these objects are, you know, I think, you know, would be very foolish to do it without thinking about how modern sociologists have discussed souvenirs. I mean, the problem, as always, with the ancient world is quite how similar is it? Quite how, you know, is this an identical experience? Is it partly overlapping, but partly very different? And there's one particular group of objects that both the writers in the books I discuss talk about, which are extraordinary, rather beautiful glass flasks with the cityscape of the towns of Baiae and Puteoli from the Bay of Naples. Roman, they look like Roman souvenirs. They look like, you know, I've been to Baiae and I've gone home with a glass flask with the seafront of Baiae scratched out on it. Where you can, and it's not always easy, but you then look at where these things were found. And several of the ones we know were found in graves. And you think, okay, this is a souvenir, but I don't get buried with my ouzo bottle. Are these things doing something very different in the ancient world from what our souvenirs do? Maybe they are. You can't quite tell that they are fulfilling the same function.
There's always a danger, as you say, isn't there, of because we, especially because we recognise the object, there's a danger to leap to it and go, well, they're doing what we do.
That's right. And in part, maybe they were, but in part, maybe these are fitting into the kind of culture of the ancient world in a significantly different way. Now, I can't begin to think what the connection between a glass flask with the cityscape of Baiae on it and the rituals of death. But it looks as if there was one in a way that there isn't now.
Is it so widespread that, I mean, you know, sometimes people are buried with favourite objects. I mean, could it be that sort of simple, or is it too widespread? Does it happen too frequently for that to be likely?
We're dealing with quite a small sample. let me be honest, it's very hard to know. And, you know, you can say, look, this is very precious to somebody. What do you do with burials? You can't get buried with something very precious to you. And it's as simple as that. Some of the inscriptions that are also on them, there's the kind of the cityscape is engraved, but then there's little messages are engraved, also look a bit like funerary things, you know? You know, the memory of my bright light and this kind of thing. So I think it's puzzling. My favourite example, though, actually, is one where I think for once we can actually be pretty certain that we're dealing with something which is absolutely spot on our experience. Because a few years ago, there was a metal stylus for writing discovered in Roman London. And it's got a kind of very, very tiny, difficult to read verse on it. But as far as you can decode it, and I think it's this is fairly certain, it does actually say, you know, I went to the big city and all I brought you was this rotten pen. Partly, we are in the same world. Now, I think at the margins, we might not be.
That's perfect, isn't it? It's wonderful to find something like that and go, there, see, you show it to someone and say, look, that present wasn't so bad.
They were like us, after all.
We can think that we're part of a long and noble tradition.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Beginning with at least Hadrian.
Yes, no need to feel ashamed.
You've made me feel so much better about my goldfinch fridge magnet, I must say.
Oh yeah, I'm a big fan of all these things.
The Romans would have so liked the fridge magnet, I think.
Both beautiful and useful for holding up your shopping list.
They'd also quite like a selfie, I can't help but imagine. You know, if only Hadrian had his smartphone.
You'd be sifting through them even now, Mary. That's what you'd be doing. Thank you very much for enlightening us and liberating us from any lingering shame we may have felt about our knickknacks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, our roundup of summer reading with Toby Lichtig. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. It's that time of year when, despite flight cancellations, heat waves, and rail strikes, our thoughts turn to hanging around at Heathrow or Paddington for 4 to 6 hours and then having to stay inside all day because we've got heat stroke. Or, alternatively, stretching out on the silver sands in front of an azure sea, banana daiquiri in one hand and Herodotus in the original in the other. Whichever way it cashes out, you're going to need something to read. So we asked some of our wonderful writers what they're packing in their designer holdalls and little bags for life this year. Here to help us rummage through their luggage is Toby Lichtig, fiction and politics editor of the TLS. Thanks for joining us, Toby.
Hello, thank you for having me, as ever.
Well, we can gang up now, and together we can have a very exclusive talk to the first person on the Summer Books reading list, who is none other than Alex Clark.
That's a bit of a cheat. It's a bit of a cheat, this, isn't it?
So well, I thought you were going to say a coup. I think it's a coup that we've got.
Yes, quite so, Toby. I don't open my raffia bag for everyone, but I have to say that I'm first on the list, I think, because of the alphabet. It's always, I think it's an alphabetical order, and it's always good to have a name quite up the top. I don't think it's in order of importance. I will say, when you do these things, we all know this, you're absolutely terrified, and you think, well, I really, you know, there are luminaries being asked to pick their reading, and I'm really glad I don't know what their things are. It's a sort of race to the top of the kind of obscurity chart sometimes, isn't it?
No, and I mean, nobody says I will, you know, immediately go to the airport bookshop and buy the first thing with gold letters I can see. And I would you simply, didn't say that either.
I didn't say that. And I don't find any holiday like that complete without a trip to the travel exclusive section with the great big books. It's just cheerful, isn't it, buying a book at the airport? But no, I didn't. You're absolutely right.
It is cheerful.
You have chosen a great big book, though, nonetheless.
I've chosen an enormous book. I started off with Pogue Mahone by Patrick McCabe, which, well, what can we say? It's a kind of family story, but it is a novel in verse, and it's about a family of Irish emigres and their life in London told over many years. Now, the rather delightful thing when somebody says, what are you going to read, is you can't be expected to be super well versed in it, because it's what you're taking, not what you've already read. So I am going to tell you that I'm excited to know how it's going to unfold, but I don't know that yet. What I do know is it's big, it's in verse, and it's about the Irish in Britain over the kind of last half of the 20th century and this century.
David Collard reviewed it for the TLS last month, and I think it was in the May, the 2020th issue, something like that, and was very in favour of it, full of praise. So you listeners could look up that review as well.
I would also come up with a little side thing, which I don't really know how to say this without sounding, frankly, like the sort of landed gentry, which I'm not. But I have a man that helps with my field, because I've got a field.
That sounds
like the absolutely landed sounds gentry. Like a gymkhana. And what that actually translates to is, can you help me fight back an acre of hawthorns and brambles, actually what that really means. But he is the most extraordinary reader, and he often comes in and we have a chat about books, always lending me books, and I lent him Pogue Mahone before I had a chance to read it, because he was so excited to see it there, and he says it's absolutely brilliant. So David Collard and Neil, my field man, have given it the thumbs up, so I'm hoping I will too.
There's no higher praise. And do you want to just remind us what Pogue Mahone means?
Am I allowed to?
Well, I think so. Or you could do as kind of a gentler version.
I should say, well, it means kiss my ass. There's no TLS listeners don't
can handle that
gentility. Yeah. They're fine. They can handle that. I've also chosen, just very briefly, All Our Yesterdays by Natalia Ginsberg, who's a writer I really, really love. And Invisible Child, it's a Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Andrea Elliot. And actually, this is a Hay thing, Lucy. You'll remember.
Yes,
we met her at Hay, and she talked so vividly about this kind of mammoth work of nonfiction that she spent years putting together, a feat of reportage, really, about the homeless children of Brooklyn, that I thought, well, that's something I'm going to read. Because one of the things, I suppose, about reading when at your leisure is it's really nice to have a kind of balance of stuff. And that often includes, for me, fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah, no, and it sounds like an amazing work. It's kind of what do you call it? It's like embedded reporting, as it were. It's in-depth sort of reporting.
Yes, and it is very big. And I do like a very big book to read at my leisure, don't you?
Yes, it's especially if you're not the sort of person. I'm actually very bad. I probably shouldn't admit this. I'm not very good at taking care of books very well. My books tend to look a bit battered and rubbish, and I don't mind that, because I think they look loved and lived in. So as long as you don't, you know, as long as you don't need your book to stay pristine, I love having a great big book to lug around, and then you spill things on it and, you know, it gets trodden on or something.
Yeah, and you get bits of sand in it. You want that when you pick up your books years later to remember, you know, what it was you stained them with and where you were with them. I think it's really important, actually.
Yeah, I think so. Did we notice any trends or any themes emerging this year, do we think, in what people are choosing? I think you've started one, Alex, because quite a lot of people were talking about Natalia Ginsberg, it seemed to me.
Yes, Caroline Moorhead, I think, who's also recommended Janet Malcolm's Reading Chekhov, which I thought, right, I must get that for my own list. But yes, she recommended. I mean, I think people are really interested in rediscovery, aren't they? Is that something that you've found, Toby?
Yes, rediscoveries and sort of old classics that they've been meaning to read for a long time. So I know Irina Dumitrescu has tipped a book that I'd never heard of by Matteo Caragiale, Rakes of the Old Court, which is a Romanian classic about men drinking and gambling in pre-war Bucharest. Sounds utterly brilliant. So I think, yes, those books that we've been meaning to catch up on for many years, and also reissues as well. I think, yeah, that tends to be quite a holiday theme, doesn't it?
Yes, and there were different attitudes, because I think, well, we do summer books every year, and for the past couple of years, people haven't been moving around very much at all, been kind of worried about it if they were. And there was a different attitude here. Some people were saying, OK, I'm going to zip around as much as I can. One of our contributors has already been up the side of Mount Etna and told us what book she was reading. And some people saying, I'm going to stay put. And I've got all these books lined up to read. There's kind of different vibes out there, aren't there?
So I think there was probably last year when people were doing even more staying put, I think there was kind of more of a need to be transported, wasn't there, by the books themselves. Whereas I've noticed in this selection, there is more sense of people actually being able to go on holiday this year, which is nice. Not everyone, but most people.
Yeah. So, Toby, whose bag of books would you like to just quietly make off with if you're standing waiting for your luggage? You just sneak off with it.
Just sneak off at the airport. Well, that is a good question. Possibly Claire Loudon, partly because I like her dedication to oeuvre. So she said she's been having a Mary McCarthy-ish May. I mean, I like the idea of that to start with. She's read her intellectual memoirs and then her debut novel, The Company She Keeps, and she's going to carry on with McCarthy. Not a writer I know. I mean, I know a bit about her, but I've read very little of her. So she's going to read a biography, seeing Mary Plain by Frances Kiernan, and then Mary McCarthy's novel The Group, which I've always been meaning to read. And I think it's a sort of a jealousy thing. I mean, you know, we can all do what we want, obviously, but I find with my job as fiction editor, I tend to sort of read relatively widely in terms of the new novels coming in. And, you know, I sometimes have opportunity to catch up on those books I've always been meaning to read, but I very rarely have the chance, or rather I very rarely make the time to actually really dive into a whole catalogue of books by a single author. And in my fantasy holiday or my fantasy desert island by myself with my ginger. Did I say by myself?
That's very revealing. You yes. did.
My
great asperity, yes. really, didn't you?
Absolutely.
He? Force.
Entirely alone, left to my own devices, I would like to dive in, spend a month, maybe 4 months, I don't know, with Mary McCarthy.
I'm a bit worried though, because you did say you hadn't read much of hers. What if after the first book you were like, yeah, it's fine, and then all you had was Mary McCarthy?
Well, you know, I'm prepared to take gambles on these things, and you know, possibly that's the way to really get into a writer's work. You keep plugging away until you find the ones you really like. And I suppose if it all, you know, it was a disaster, I'll just get my Kindle out.
Well, I think The Group is a book that is so entertaining, and I really I do recommend it. And also, you know, interesting to read alongside a sort of kind of modern version of it, Lara Feigl's The Group.
Yes, which came out last year.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a kind of interesting thing. But I think also, Toby, what we should say on a fantasy desert island, wouldn't it be great to have a kind of floating sort of mobile bookshop that perhaps came round once a week, and you could sort of get a little you could row out to it, and perhaps, you know, that as
this
we're creating
to a
fantasy.
Different program that reminds me of another one. What's your fifth record?
Nobody ever says on that program when they say what's your luxury, I'd say a shop. That's what I'd want. But nobody ever says that, do they?
I'm sure someone said a bookshop, but you're right, it's an all-purpose shop.
That would be a brilliant idea, wouldn't it? Can I have, yeah, can I just, yeah.
John Lewis, I'd always, all day long, I'd want John Lewis. Anyway, that's beside the point. So
we are digressing.
After you come back from your exfiltrated, I imagine, by your family who are missing you desperately, Toby, from this fantasy desert island, who else on this kind of who's taken your eye as something you think? Well, that's a good recommendation.
A couple of people take my eye. I mean, this is not necessarily a book I want to read, but I was very interested in Joyce Carol Oates's decision to read. I'll read her excerpt briefly. A portion of my summer reading will be devoted to research into the extraordinary career and life of America's father of neurology, Silas Weir Mitchell, most famous or infamous for being the highly respected physician who devised the hellish rest cure that was the catalyst for Charlotte Perkins Gilman's story, The Yellow Wallpaper. And she goes on and talks about the books she's going to read around him. And what I particularly like about this is she ends by saying, there's no telling where this subject may lead, but no doubt to a surreal sort of quasi-historical fiction. And I like the sense you get there of Joyce Carol Oates, who is still indefatigably producing, you know, two novels a year, as far as I can gather, well into her 80s. And, you know, this is her writing process. She's taking these books on her summer holiday, and no doubt by next January, we will be getting proof copies of her new novel about Silas Weir Mitchell. So I thought it was quite a nice little insight in her process.
Yes, I loved that too. I thought, my God, you're on it again, JCO. I thought, here we go. It was a chuckly moment there. It was when again, it's a sort of insight. And of course, this is partly also what happens when you read people's recommendations. You do get little glimpses into their lives, don't you?
Yeah.
But yes, exactly. I love to think of Benjamin Markovitz reading Philip Larkin's A Girl in Winter recently. And I thought, what a juxtaposition of a sort of Anglo-American with somebody we think of as so English. And that, you know, fascinating, really. And that's led him on to talking about Tessa Hadley. And then I started thinking about Philip Larkin in concert with Tessa Hadley. And it's just very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Everyone shoved up together in the same holiday bag. Alex, whose bag would you be tempted to sneak off with, do you think?
Well, you see, I
suppose you've got your own bag. Sorry, you can't have
your bag. I've got my own bag, but I did a little bit. I did a little bit of, I'm having one from hers, one from his. And I love the Japanese novelist Mieko Kawakami. Barbara King has recommended All the Lovers in the Night, which I haven't read. So that was something that I thought I might want to take. I've mentioned the Janet Malcolm that Caroline Moorhead recommended reading Chekhov. And then also really another reading project, actually. Nicola Shulman talked about really getting to grips with the work of Percival Everett. Not novelist I'd ever read. And I thought, that's a really good idea.
I've read a couple of his novels. Erasure was one of them. It was extraordinarily good. And I'm Not Sidney Poitier is another one.
And I've read that too. It's absolutely brilliant.
He's really brilliant, isn't he? He's been writing since the early 80s. He's written about 20 novels, and he's sort of reasonably well known in some circles, but basically not particularly well known, particularly in the UK. And he's having a bit of a revival over here, as in some of his books that have never before appeared in the UK are being published here. And I think it's great because he really should be better known. He's a fascinating writer.
Yes, I thought I Am Not Sidney Poitier was so, it wasn't like anything else I'd ever read. And it did immediately make you want to think, oh, okay, what else has he done? That would be, what does she say? Nicholas Shulman says he's a writer of staggering gifts and the range of an inquisitive blue whale. Which is a good way of
Lord.
Of saying
I mean,
it
immediately made me think, what is an inquisitive blue whale like? You can imagine them sort of just bumping up to you, kind of
pretty anyway. Inquisitive, I think.
Yeah. pretty inquisitive. Lucy, we're gonna have to turn this on to you though. What are you gonna be taking?
Well, that was one of them, actually, I'm afraid. Well, it's not one of them because she's sort of saying all of Percival Everett's work, but I would definitely be interested in that. I'd quite like to have Andrew Motion's bag because he's chosen Elizabeth Lowry's The Chosen. In fact, we had Elizabeth on the podcast, but I haven't read the book yet and I very much want to. It's about Thomas Hardy's reaction to the death of his wife, Emma Hardy. Which just sounds brilliant and interesting and all of those things. And I very much want to read, and have not yet, you two probably have, you've read everything, The Last Days of Roger Federer by Jeff Dyer. Have you read it?
I'm reading it and I'm really enjoying it.
Okay, good.
I haven't and I would like to. And she also, I have read though, the Klaas Swat puts her hand up. I have read one of the other books that she recommends, Elif Batuman's Either Or, which I hugely enjoyed. So
you loved, oh good, I'm glad you loved it, because I've been meaning to read that. Claire Loudon reviewed it for us last
month, and she was very pro it. it's really good.
And does one start with that one or the earlier one, The Idiot? Because it's a sort of a follow-up to The Idiot, but you can read it separately.
It is. You absolutely can read it separately. I would, especially since we know you're going to be 4 months on this desert island. I would absolutely definitely start with The Idiot. And I actually, to be honest, I might go back and read The Possessed, her first book with nonfiction, because she's just such a gifted writer. And sometimes, you know, the heart does occasionally sink at the kind of, you know, talks about her life in books sort of marketing line. But she does it so, she's so brilliant at conjoining literature and life and working out this kind of alchemy and how people's lives can be shaped by books as well as all the other circumstances in their lives that they then bring to bear on reading those books. It's, she's a great, great, great writer.
Okay, well, she's going in the bag as well. And can I have one more? Please, can I have one more for my eighth record? Is Neal Stephenson's. Regina Reaney has chosen Neal Stephenson's Termination Shock. She says, the weary techno-prophet turns his side eye to climate change, which another sort of science fiction, speculative fiction writer, Kim Stanley Robinson, did with his last book, which I read. It was quite a difficult read. You know, it wasn't all fun, but it was incredibly interesting and actually quite hopeful. And Neal Stephenson's really interesting. He writes great big books, Alex. If you they're you know, it's 700-800 pages type thing. And I do think it's interesting that these people who were writing about colonizing Mars and, you know, quite hard science fiction is what they were doing. Quite a lot of them are now turning to climate fiction, basically, and having a look at this planet, as it were, and saying, okay, what's going to happen?
Is it yet called Cli-Fi?
I'm afraid it is.
It is. Yes. Okay.
Unfortunately.
Right. I wonder if that's something I'm sorry to, we mustn't end on a sort of gloomy note, but I wonder if that's something that we should mention to Ian Sansom, who, I mean, Ian Sansom always makes me laugh, but the beginning of his little choice starts, appalled, dismayed, and disgusted at the general state of things, I am looking forward to spending my staycation this year with books that promise to plunge me deeper into despair. And I salute that, Ian, even though I think, you know, throw Jilly Cooper's Riders in there or something like that. You know, come on, cheer yourself up a bit.
It doesn't sound as though he's going to, does it?
It doesn't really.
No, he's chosen George Monbiot's Regenesis, Feeding the World Without Devouring a Planet, which I think actually does offer some hope. And some
message
answers.
Of hope there, isn't there? A solution, perhaps.
I think so, yeah. He also says Hannah White's Held in Contempt, which Edward Docks talked about recently on the podcast with great urgency and conviction. And that one I don't think is terribly hopeful. And then he says, to put the icing on the whole sorry cake, Dave Golson's Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse. So that's not, it's not the most fun list, is it?
Well,
I mean, there are solutions. And I think even Hannah White offers some solutions. So.
It's fun, really, what we need. I have to say, there's no insect apocalypse in my kitchen at the minute. But anyway, this heat wave, guys.
I know,
I do like to think, as we see, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times, very sort of narcissistically, really, books that have come up on the podcast that have appeared, that now seems to have nudged people. Do you think we are fulfilling our dream of being trendsetters and tastemakers, Lucy?
Well, we can but dream, Alex. Not for us to say, is what I'm going to say to
you. No, that is for others who will no doubt very kindly agree with us. Right.
Or not. And Toby, we've just got time before we go to ask what you will be taking when you're not stealing other people's bags. What will you be putting in your bag?
Well, a couple of things, but I'm going to start off by breaking all the rules, which is that I'd like to mention a book that I've already read on my summer holidays and that isn't out yet.
That's definitely breaking all
those, but it's out in very early September, so you know, late summer, and actually going away in September is lovely. If I didn't have small children and schools and things like that to worry about, I would definitely be trying to go on holiday in September. And I did go on a holiday in May, to Italy, and I took this book with me. It is called Dandelions, and it is by the TLS podcast one and only Fiolena Duzzi.
Oh, I have heard of her.
Yes, she's very good. Well, it turns
You're not
out
allowed to do that either, but do tell us about
it. No, absolutely. I mean, private, I will be all over this. I'm going to hold up my hands. Of course, you know, Thea is a dear friend and dear colleague, and she's wonderful. But this book is utterly nothing to do with the fact that it's by Fiolena Duzzi. It is totally brilliant. And actually, one of the highest bits of praise I can say about it is I completely forgot it was by Thea, and I was just reading it as a book. It is about her family. It's sort of through the voice of her nonna, this woman in her mid-90s, reflecting on her long life and the families shuttling between Italy and the UK. It was a wonderful, you know, I was in Italy when I was reading it, so that was wonderful. And it's about these different generations moving from Italy from the north of Italy to the north of Manchester, and the kind of social history around that. And it is so beautifully written. Dandelions, I massively recommend it. And yes, it's out early September. Please go and read it. So that's one of my recommendations. Yeah. And I don't know if I've got time for a quick other
you
one.
You have, go on, go on. But you have one that won't get us in private eye for
Logrong. Won't get us in private eye.
I'm desperate to read to
you. I know that sounds like Logrong, but it's so good. The other is a book I've just started. It's a book of short stories. It's called God's Children Are Little Broken Things. It's out next month. It's by Arinze Efeakandu. I hope I pronounced that correctly. He is a Nigerian novelist, and I've just read the first two, or rather, he's a Nigerian author. This is a book of short stories, and I've just read the first two. It's these beautiful, beautiful stories about gay love in Nigeria, you know, relationships, sort of Lagos life. It's really, really beautifully done. It comes garlanded with recommendations by people like Damon Galgut, Edwin White, Adam Hazlitt, and I'm really keen to take that onto my desert island and finish it in peace, as I mentioned.
Brilliant. Well, yes, do think of us all alone on your desert island.
He won't.
He won't. He'll be too busy reading those brilliant books and having a great time.
See you soon, Toby, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've got time for this week. I hope you enjoyed listening to Mary Beard and Toby Lichtig. Thank you for listening to the TLS podcast produced by Charlotte Pardy. And we'll have another roundup for you next week. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.